Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Today, President Trump sent an early morning tweet warning North Korea that the U.S. is locked and loaded. As the fighting words continue to intensify, others in government and in the military are urging more calm reactions. That would include retired Air Force Lieutenant General Dan Leaf, a former deputy commander of the U.S. Pacific Command. He says a military strike would have great risk and a low probability of long-term success. General Dan Leaf joins us now. Thanks for coming back. Good to talk to you as always.
Aloha, Beth Ann. Happy to be here.
Now, you heard the news just a few moments ago as we were all listening. And again, more rhetoric from the president saying that, if Kim Jong-un decides to attack the U.S. or any of its allies or protectorates, that he would be responding in kind with similar military strikes. That's a different, perhaps a different stance than saying that we're going to go and attack first. And China is also looking at that as being a defining line in the way it responds. Not a lot of people are hearing that latter part. What exactly is China saying?
Well, there was an article in the Global Times, a party paper, that said that, in essence, if North Korea started something, say launched a missile attack on U.S. territory, they would not come to their aid in whatever ensued. They also said that they would come to North Korea's aid if the United States initiated hostilities. So the first part, I think, is a very reassuring statement from a quasi-official paper. And I'm sure it will be heard by Kim Jong-un. And President Trump's words, while you may argue the style, that's a statement that has to be made to Kim Jong-un, the primary audience for the statement, that the U.S. will respond and not sit idly. He has to understand that. Again, you can argue the style of it. But
in terms of the substance, you think that was quite correct in being able to have a direct statement that will resonate in Kim Jong-un's mind?
I think it's absolutely necessary, unfortunately. And again, the choice of words many of us would have used said it differently. But the audience is Kim Jong-un, and he has to understand that any further provocation, especially carrying through on their threat to attack Guam or the waters around Guam or any other U.S. territory or ally, will deliver consequences that he can't afford in terms of keeping his regime alive and his country as sustainable as it is.
Avoiding those consequences would be a successful outcome that many people would like to see happen. But not just in your mind, especially in this particular instance, but for a long time you've advocated that we have to have a long-reaching plan, and that there has to be something that's going to have the greatest chance for long-term success. Again, that long view that some say they're not sure that the president is taking. Are you?
I don't know, because I haven't spoken with the president about it. I don't know that we've sustained a long view on North Korea throughout the past several administrations. There have been efforts to engage and efforts to counter North Korea. And we're still in a pretty bad place, as this crisis demonstrates. And so when people ask me here in Hawaii, what can I do? What should I do about this? And say, don't forget, this crisis will most likely pass. But don't forget that we have a big problem that we have to solve for two reasons. One is the threat of military conflict, which would be devastating to Korea's, both North and South, but really to the world because of the second and third order consequences. And the second thing that I'd like them not to forget is there's a humanitarian disaster in North Korea now. Two-thirds of the population has suffered unnecessarily for decades, and we shouldn't be comfortable with that. Until we resolve the military side of the confrontation and standoff that we've had with North Korea, that will not be fully addressed.
Is this why you have been saying that we should take these threats very seriously, but that we shouldn't be in a panic over them?
That's exactly why. We have to deal with them. And I'm sure that our military commanders here at Pacific Command, Admiral Harris, General Brooks at U.S. Forces Korea, and all of their teams are prepared and ready and doing everything they can to both deter and be ready for any action by North Korea. But we've got to go beyond that and solve the problem. And that's not just military. It is fundamentally diplomatic.
Diplomacy, though, has been suffering of late, and we aren't even fully staffed when it comes to having all ambassadors in place, not necessarily in countries that would be directly involved, but certainly peripherally involved.
Yes, Secretary of Defense Mattis made a very thoughtful statement yesterday about now is it's time for diplomacy to work. And we had a diplomatic success in getting the sanctions passed in the United Nations 15-0. But all of the diplomacy doesn't happen just in New York at the UN or in Washington, D.C. It happens in the region. And we do not have sitting ambassadors in South Korea, very importantly, in Singapore, where one's been nominated but not yet confirmed, in India, or to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN. Those are critical peripheral. South Korea is not peripheral, but the other ones are important places of influence. You can't do diplomacy without diplomats. And so if you want to know what you can do, I say to your listeners, write to the president, write to Congress, tell them to get those posts filled. It's absolutely essential. In my time at Pacific Command and later at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, I got to see daily, really, the importance of our top diplomats in all of the countries of the region.
In being able to confirm those diplomats and have them appointed, not having them be political footballs would seem to be especially important now.
That's absolutely true, and there's a responsibility on both sides of the aisle. This is an emergency. I mean, the threat to strike Guam is an emergency situation. Part of treating it like the crisis that it is should be a bipartisan, concerted effort to get those key diplomatic posts filled.
Aside from having those posts filled and as quickly as possible in your mind, what would you see as being a comprehensive long-term strategy that needs to be put in place and continually worked as we move through not just this crisis, perhaps, but as we move into the future, 5, 10, and years beyond?
Well, there are many facets that we can work with regard to North Korea. We shouldn't expect North Korea to change suddenly or collapse. Many have anticipated that for years. It hasn't come. Neither has happened. So engagement with North Korea on areas of interest like the armistice, which is a bone of contention and a football that North Korea likes to play with, on the maritime boundaries on the west coast of North Korea, where they got a bad deal at the end of the war. I'm not advocating concessions to North Korea, but we believe in the rule of law at sea and revising those boundaries, not the U.S.'s responsibility, but is an effort that should be taken. We should insist more aggressively on progress in human rights and addressing the starvation endemic to the country. So take all of those avenues and find any that you can make progress in, not expecting a miracle cure, but find places to make progress while continuing to insist on denuclearization. And I think we have to continue to insist on a denuclearized North Korea. It's not likely to happen soon, but we shouldn't let go of that.
Do we also need to understand and stop using the word crazy? Do we understand that this word really doesn't apply to Kim Jong-un, that we're not talking about someone who is crazy, but someone who is highly calculating?
Using the word crazy to describe North Koreans in general, or Kim Jong-un in particular, drives me crazy because it's not very thoughtful. And if you look at what North Korea and the regime have endured, survived, and actually made money, if you will, out of, they have to be pretty successfully calculating to get through all the sanctions and survive as a regime, to develop the missile technology that they've developed, to apparently develop a weaponized warhead-size nuclear weapon. There's no crazy in that. Crazy, as Einstein said, is doing the same thing over and over again, thinking that fails every time, thinking will work. So we have to be less crazy and find different approaches that will work.
What do you think has to be the very next step of all the things that you've talked about and outlined and see as a long-range plan? What do you think has to happen first?
In terms of a short time frame, we're not going to fill the diplomatic posts right away. We have to continue to demonstrate resolve, and I think pursue deterrence through investment in missile defense, particularly of Hawaii. I think Kim Jong-un does calculate what might work and that strengthening our defense here is important.
Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Beth Ann. Thank you.
Retired Air Force Lieutenant General Dan Leaf is the President and Managing Director of Phase Minus One. He previously served as the Director of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu and the Deputy Commander of the U.S. Pacific Command.
Guam was bumped to the top of the news cycle last week by a very specific threat from North Korea, the announcement of a plan to set off a, quote, enveloping fire of test missiles. Saber-rattling by world leaders rarely goes into that kind of detail, with designated splashdown points and travel times for the missiles, missiles North Korea is reportedly able to arm with nuclear warheads. We asked Jefferson Cronin, Morning Edition host at KPRG Guam Public Radio, to tell us how it feels to be there right now. Hi, Jefferson. Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You've heard threats addressed specifically to Guam before, but what's different about this one?
Well, it's the nuclear aspect that's different this time. We have been threatened by, you know, specifically on a number of occasions already. And so this is a little different because of the nuclear aspect and because of the attention it's getting from around the world, probably due to the president's reaction to it.
Well, give us an outline, because a lot of Americans are sadly just finding out about Guam through this.
Sure.
What's the strategic importance here, geographically?
Well, they call us the tip of the spear. That's what the military, how the military refers to us here. We are the closest American soil to Asia. By air, we're about 4 hours south of Tokyo and about 4 hours east of Manila. And so that puts us, and so it's, and you know, on Guam, we're kind of used to this. We're not just the threats, but the idea of being this outpost of the United States.
Yeah.
You know, in World War II, Guam became the first substantially inhabited American soil to be conquered by a foreign power. And we still have plenty of people here who were prisoners and slaves during World War II. So there's a pretty defiant attitude here, while, of course, tempering that with concern.
One of the things about America in general is that it's often said about us is that, unlike European nations, we haven't had that experience of being occupied, as you said, enslaved. But Guam's different that way, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this is a still a fresh memory because it's part of the culture here. That generation is sadly mostly gone, although there are plenty of them still left. You know, we had many people now who were those prisoners during the war were just children at the time. And they have grown up with this, and families have grown up with this. So it is, I mean, it's interesting here. You know, we're used to natural disasters, typhoons, earthquakes, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so we are prepared. As a matter of fact, the local Homeland Security just put out a pamphlet on what to do in case we are attacked by a nuclear weapon. So, yeah, we're getting prepared for it, but we're, you know, not just the attack, but the Guam attitude is we've got plenty of barbecue.
Well, Jefferson, those safety measures that you heard about, what kind of things are they? Because, you know, some of us remember the duck and cover days, right?
Absolutely, I do. It reminds me so much of that.
Because I heard something yesterday where they're saying, you know, stay away from windows in the event of a nuclear attack. Yeah, stay away from windows is probably not going to help all that much, right?
No. And they're saying, you know, don't look into the flash because that can blind you. You know, I have to say, my attitude sounds like it's kind of like yours because I grew up in the Cold War right outside D.C.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And, the whole duck and cover thing, and you want to survive a nuclear attack, and you can, and here's how you should do it, that attitude. We practiced all that. My father was with the State Department, and I remember as a kid, he said to us, do whatever you're told to do, but realize that if it ever happens, you're going to see this big flash, and you're going to go, what the? And then it'll all be over, so don't worry about it.
Well, at least, but, this whole thing of the whole duck and cover thing, I remember at the time as a kid thinking, how is this wooden desk going to protect me, right? And
yeah, right.
I wonder about the value of false reassurance,
I think that may be a concern with some folks. From what I get from my conversations with people, the one extreme is near panic, and there are some people who are pretty freaked out, but most are not. I think this whole idea. We have to be prepared, of course, and the government is doing their best to reassure people. So there isn't panic, and there isn't lack of a measured response. Maybe is a good way to put it. The mood is still very positive and upbeat here. We're getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
from the as well as from the United States, neither of which we're used to. I know in Hawaii, being sort of left out of the loop is like.
Yeah, an island in the Pacific, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's the way we feel most of the time. And now we're getting all this attention. We've got international pressure, and all of a sudden people are concerned about Guam, which is, that's probably good for us in the long run. But we wish the circumstances were different.
Well, because of the circumstances and because of your past history, as the tip of the spear, I suspect there's a very different consciousness there as far as these alarms and excursions, because you can't spend your life in a state of alarm, right? You have to...
Of course.
And you've been there before where you were the target of a threat. It's just the nuclear aspect and the specificity of the threat,
right,
that might be move it up a notch.
Well, and the U.S. response,
yeah,
which is the key, I think, to the whole thing. People are asking this question a lot. Why is the president playing Kim Jong-un's game?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's feeding right into him. We know here that when he rattles his saber and threatens us, as he's done before, it's really an internal political move. I mean, he's trying to solidify his own position politically, internally, and that's what he does. He pokes the bear when tells his people that they're in danger from us, and that's one of the ways he keeps his own power there. And we know that, and a lot of people know that, feeding into that gives him more credibility or more juice in his own political sphere, that's the big difference, is the response from Washington.
And if we didn't respond that way, it would just be more posturing.
As we've seen before. I mean, I think the nuclear aspect is the thing that is the key, the thing that is sort of got everybody unnerved.
Yeah.
Of course, rightly so. We have to be aware. We have to be concerned. We have to be on top of it. But, I think the U.S. military is on top of it. They know where these things are, and they know... they know a lot more about it than they're ever going to tell us,
Well, let's hope so, Jefferson, it's been...
I think so.
It's really valuable to talk to you about this. I appreciate it. Well, thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure anytime.
We'll check in with you again as events develop, but thanks very much.
Oh, please do.
Jefferson Cronin is the morning edition host at KPRG, Guam Public Radio, as well as a professor of communications, English, and humanities at the University of Maryland University College Asian Division. He's lived in Guam for 23 years. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, separating heat from light in the GMO debate. But first, your quiz. Much of the country and many places around the world have turned their eyes on Guam in recent days, and so will our backyard quiz today. Guam was originally settled by the Chamorro people, whose ancestors began moving across Oceania as early as 2000 BC. The famous circumnavigator Ferdinand Magellan was the first European to make landfall at Guam while on a voyage of exploration for the King of Spain in 1521. Spanish colonists arrived 160 years later, beginning more than 200 years of Spanish rule over Guam. That rule came to an abrupt end following Spain's 1898 defeat in the Spanish-American War, which is how the United States came to administer the island. Guam changed hands again when the forces of the Japanese Empire invaded on December 8, 1941, mere hours after the surprise attack at Pearl Harbor. Although the Japanese occupation of Guam lasted only 31 months, survivors of the Imperial Japanese Army held out on Guam in secret for years. So, for today's backyard quiz, we want to know, in what year did the last Japanese soldier from World War II surrender on Guam? If you know the answer, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the Backyard Quiz tote bag that tells everybody you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Hawaii Pacific University, and Ulupono Initiative.
With the Hawaii primary election only a year away, why is Governor Ige's coffer so low? Civil Beat political and opinion editor Chad Blair considered that question, and he joins us now for a reality check. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Beth Ann.
Okay, so Governor David Ige has just $250,000 in his reelection war chest. It should maybe not be lost on us that he had about double that when he challenged Governor Ige, Governor Abercrombie, to... in the primary not that long ago, but would you have expected that he would have far more in his coffers by now?
Yes. Incumbent governors hold fundraisers. They raise money precisely because they want to win a second term. And at this time, 3 years ago, when Governor Ige was considering challenging Governor Abercrombie, Neil Abercrombie had over $2 million in cash on hand. And, of course, everybody thought he was going to speed to re-election. Well, that didn't turn out that way. Even though Abercrombie outspent Ige by 10 to 1, it was like $5 million to $500,000. Ige, of course, won in a historic landslide. Still, one wonders whether Ige, having so little money, is that an indication that support for his reelection is soft? I think that is the reality check for this morning. And as you know, there are people that are talking about challenging him.
Yeah, and that's part of why you would think that maybe he would be wanting to have more in his war chest. Or is it the idea that, you know, perhaps he feels that he won with just 500,000, as you mentioned, you know, 10 to 1 ratio when he challenged Governor Abercrombie. Maybe he feels that it's not about the money.
Well, he did, in fact, end up raising about $2 million himself once he got past the primary, once he defeated Abercrombie in 2014. He then, remember, had three challengers, Mufi Hanneman and Duke Iona, and there was a Libertarian candidate as well. So it was a crowded field. So he ended up raising a lot of money. In fact, between the primary in August and the general election in November that year, he practically had a fundraiser every day. So clearly he knows how to do it. Clearly he knows that you need money. I mean, just for the advertising alone, running TV commercials, print newspaper ads online, you can't run with only $500,000 for a statewide office. Although, yes, I know he did it in the primary, but if he's going to run the general, he's going to need money.
Especially if he's challenged by certain people, including perhaps Colleen Hanabusa.
Right. That's the big elephant in the room, so to speak. And there's others as well. The mayor of Kauai, Bernard Carvalho, has been talked about as a possible candidate. The governor himself knows there will be a contested primary. So if that's the case, you do need to get the word out. Wonder why more money isn't going his way.
And have you been able to unearth any reasons for that, that others are
hanging
by and they're just waiting to see what's going to happen before they decide where they're going to put their money? But clearly giving it directly to him.
Exactly. They didn't respond to us. I could tell you real quickly, a lot of Ige's own staff gave him money. So that's interesting. They want to keep their jobs.
Well, that may be a few other
Who
things.
Who doesn't?
Have a good weekend, Chad. Talk to you later.
Yeah, thanks, Bethann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair.
Not that long ago, we ate three times a day with little thought about where our food came from. Now we examine it in minute detail. Everyone has an opinion, and few subjects are as likely to provoke those opinions as the ongoing quarrel over genetic modification of our food. Are GMOs a legitimate and necessary application of science, or are they a dangerous tampering with nature? It's a debate that is complicated by excitable rhetoric and a growing anti-science movement, and it's the subject of Trace Sheehan's film Food Evolution, which is screening tomorrow afternoon in Waimea. Trace is with us in our studio. Hi, Trace. Thanks for coming in.
Hello. Aloha. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
What's the evolution of which you speak?
The evolution of food is that of which we speak. You said it very well. The GMO debate is very contentious and polarized, all those things. And
yeah.
Me and my filmmaking partner, Scott Kennedy, thought it was fertile ground to tell a story and investigate, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly of GMOs.
This particular debate has been framed by, as I also said earlier, more heat than light, and a lot of just flat-out antagonism from one side to the other. So it's not as if they're meeting to work out their differences.
It's difficult. It is absolutely difficult, and I think it's kind of a sign of the times in terms of communication and decision-making and just things getting more polarized, and food is no different. It's almost a religion, and it's, you know, food is personal. It's tied up in people's identities, so it makes sense that they want to make the best choices for themselves and for their family. But where are they getting their information from, I think, is a very important part of this equation. And we found through the journey of our film that, you know, A lot of people make decisions more based off of what they read on social media on Facebook than maybe what scientific institutions around the world have to say on the topic.
They think what their friends think.
Yeah, it's tribal communication. You know, it's confirmation bias is a term that I became familiar with through the making of this movie, and it pretty much just means that you only seek out the information that confirms your worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think there's a certain utility to that individually, in that it keeps you sane. It makes you feel like you're part of the tribe and, you know, you're all marching to the same beat. But unfortunately, it doesn't have much utility when we're talking about our democracy or making the best decisions on how we're going to feed a growing planet sustainably.
One of the things that happens with social media is that we're constantly affirming each other, right? You put up your picture on Facebook and everybody tells you how beautiful you are. And then you, in return, do the same for them. And so everybody's beautiful and everything is awesome in that world. But at the same time, you know, rigor about what's true and what ain't has sort of gone by the wayside, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm a little concerned about our ability to think critically,
mm-hmm.
to understand science and the scientific method and what it is and what it isn't. I can tell you one thing it isn't. It is not a democracy.
And it's not yet, there for our to pick and choose what.
Yeah, and yet a lot of people, they do that. They cherry pick the science that they choose to believe.
Yeah.
You know, you look a lot at the anti-GMO movement, and most of them tend to be on board with climate change, right? That is real, and there's a consensus about this.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it comes to GMOs, the same institutions that not only tell you that climate change is happening,
mm-hmm.
but also told you that, you know, tobacco is dangerous or, you know, vaccines are safe, which is another kind of rabbit hole of a topic. But
right.
These same scientific institutions that they choose to believe on the topics that they want to believe, they don't agree with them when it comes to GMOs.
Yeah.
And that cherry picking, it's hard to rationalize, you know, how you're able to do that.
Pro-GMO are at least let's take a look at GMO advocates have met with a lot of hostility, haven't they?
For sure. Yeah, because GMO has just become just bundled up with so many issues. I feel it's really become a proxy for almost every issue people have with our food and farming system, from pesticides to patents and big corporations,
mm-hmm.
and all of these issues, which are very important
issues. Pretty legitimate
issues. Yeah, they're legitimate issues. But the problem is they're not unique to GMOs. And what I mean by that is if you were to remove all GMOs tomorrow, we would still be talking about these issues,
mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, GMO is kind of a meaningless term, scientifically speaking. What it is, it's a breeding technique,
right.
Genetic engineering. It's a way to get better seeds. It's something we've been doing for thousands of years,
yeah.
But now we're doing it in a lab, and suddenly people have a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's odd, and so that's what the film is really trying to do: is just first let people know what it is, because most folks don't really know.
What kind of things did you learn by talking to the science side of this discussion?
You know, I learned from scientists and farmers why they do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not evil scientists concocting Frankenfoods to make money for,
yeah.
you know, Big M. They're good people who want to solve problems in around the world. Take, for example, here in Hawaii, Dr. Dennis Gonzalez, who was one of the inventors of the rainbow papaya.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he saved the papaya industry.
Yeah.
It was being devastated by ring spot virus. There was no other cure. There was no way to conventionally breed resistance for this disease or no organic farming practices were going to cure it.
Right.
And he got the idea to inoculate it. You know,
mm-hmm.
he took the seed, took a little bit of the virus, and it became resistant to this disease. And you know, the papaya industry is flourishing again. So, you know, that to me is a great example that people don't see when they hear about GMOs. If you're at a cocktail party and it comes up, you typically hear about corn or Monsanto. And what we found in traveling around the world is that there's a whole wave of what I like to call humanitarian GMOs,
mm-hmm.
that really are just unequivocally good. They kind of check every box that an anti might have, in that they're being developed by public sector scientists. They're not patented. They're going to be given away for free.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have anything to do with pesticides. In most cases, they lower them. nowhere was this more example more prevalent than in Uganda.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
Yeah, so banana. Bananas are very important in Uganda. It's a staple crop. I think something like a third of their calories come from bananas. And there's another disease called banana bacterial wilt that's just wiping them out. Over half of all bananas have been destroyed. So, you know, it's a serious issue in terms of food security, food insecurity. They're on the brink of famine. And there is no solution for this disease. There is, however, a GM banana that is in development, again, by a public sector scientist on the ground in Uganda. And it is resistant to the disease. The scientist, Dr. Lena Tripathi, found a gene from a bell pepper that confers resistance to this disease. And, you know, we met with these subsistence farmers who had the disease in their plantation. And once you get it, there's nothing you can do. You have to burn down your entire farm.
Yeah.
And we took some of these subsistence farmers to the lab to see it. And, you know, they were practically in tears. They wanted to take it home with them that night. They couldn't. They're not allowed. Because the fear and misinformation has spread to Uganda, and where GMOs are not allowed. And so this solution that could save a lot of lives stuck on the shelf.
That's about where the debate stands as we speak, isn't it, Trace?
It is. It's a sad state of affairs that there's a lot of sort of first worldism that comes with this debate. And I think if people could look at it more globally, they might change their minds.
Well, we'll have to see, won't we? Thanks
we
very much for
Thank
coming
you for out. Having me.
Trace Sheehan is the creator of the film Food Evolution, which will be shown at 2 p.m. tomorrow, Saturday, at the Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island. The screening is free and open to the public, and a panel discussion and Q&A session will follow that screening.
It's a Friday, and you know one of the things we like to do at the end of the week is take a look at your letters and your emails. And this week, we heard this.
After Monday's interview with John Egan about the local effects of newly proposed restrictions on legal immigration, Mititosi Kitahara wrote this on our Facebook page. Who is cleaning our offices, streets, and Hawaii while we are sleeping? They are immigrants. We have to thank them.
And following our conversation with Ken Cribbs of the Pacific Pet Alliance, John Lurch from Fort Shafter wrote, "The cat defenders' rationale and philosophies are not based on unbiased studies and only loosely in science. If there's a place the feral cat population can be eliminated, it's on an island like Oahu. It's very possible here. The cat colony supporter rhetoric is not friendly to native species and is against DLNR and state laws. Yes, they should be fined and prosecuted when caught."
Thanks for that feedback. And email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook and Twitter, or you can call our talkback line at 792-8217. In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to tell us in what year the last Japanese soldier from World War II surrendered on the Isle of Guam. The tiny Pacific island has been in the possession of a foreign power for hundreds of years, dating all the way back to Spanish colonization in the 16th century. The 1898 Treaty of Paris transferred Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico to the United States after the Spanish-American War. But the island changed hands again at the outset of World War II when Japan invaded following the attack on Pearl Harbor. That occupation lasted 31 months, with indigenous Chamorro people subjected to imprisonment, forced labor, execution, rape, and other atrocities. Japan's occupation ended in August of 1944 when the American forces recaptured the island following the Battle of Guam. However, it was not until 1972 that Japanese Army Sergeant Soichi Yokio was discovered and subdued by two local fishermen 28 years after the Battle of Guam.
And this was a very, very popular quiz, but Daryl Ito was first. He called us from Aiea, and we'll be receiving our tote bag that says You got it right. Now, if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear that quiz on a future show.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
It's a Friday, and for some of you, ending the week sipping a cool one may be a very attractive way to start your weekend. More craft breweries are opening in Hawaii. The latest opened last week in Kaka'ako, and today it will pour its very first batch. Intrepid and soon-to-be beer connoisseur Noe Tanigawa is making a study of the new pubs and the beer they're brewing. She joins us now with a preview. Now, the last time you came in and we talked beer, we also had some samples here. I'm dearly missing that chocolate porter.
I'll have to get you back out on the streets for a sample of this stuff. Beth Ann, what is happening here?
I mean, we're getting a lot of beer breweries.
Well, we really are. I mean, the National Brewer Association says that here in Hawaii, we've got 14 brewers all across the islands. Four of them right now are in Kaka'ako alone. You were talking about Waikiki Brewing. They just opened a week ago there on Queen Street. I mean, there's definitely something happening, and it's been happening the last 5 years. It wasn't long ago that Sam Choice, his Aloha Big Aloha Brewery, and Hawaiian Islands just shut down within months of each other. There was a tiny blip with Hawaiian Breach came up briefly, but I tell you, there were no craft breweries on Oahu.
So what's going on? Why suddenly now do we see these craft beers seemingly, you know, burgeoning throughout Hawaii?
Well, it's been a puzzle, and they're not exactly sure what has come together. I talked to Dave Power, who's a sales rep for Southern Glazer's Wine and Spirits, one of the biggest national liquor distributors. I asked him, has there actually been a demand for growth?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think it really started pushing maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and it just keeps growing, and there's just more and more available. You know, people are working with chefs and working with barrel aging and sour beers that are really becoming popular. And I mean, you see the growth of microbreweries just around here in Kaka'ako. There's all kinds of stuff opening, and then some of the breweries that are coming in from like really world-class breweries, we see some of them here that don't really distribute around the United States, but they like coming out to Hawaii. So we end up seeing them out here. If for no other reason, they get a tax-deductible trip to Hawaii once they're here.
So Power is saying this is a great place to drink beer, and the craft brews here are really coming on. How did it get good?
Well,
that was your question.
How did it get good? And also, why or how do we know that there's the demand for all of this? Obviously, people do their research and think that, you know, they've got to have a little due diligence before they just decide to open up a craft brewery.
You're right.
But how do we know that we have demand for this, and by whom?
What first started happening, people mention Tim Golden, who had a Beer in Hawaii blog for a number of years during the thin years. He says Real Gastro Pub that came up in Alamona Farmers Market was one of the first ones who began to have this rapidly rotating variety of really fresh beer. And he said that showed that there were people here who were interested. And then Honolulu Brewing Company opened on Cook Street. And what you really need is a brewery in any kind of beer scene. So he said that was how, of course, it was Lanikai happening, right? And Waikiki opened in Waikiki, Waikiki Brewing. So there have been these little pockets of action coming up.
So, but who's really supporting this? I mean, is there a generational divide happening with this?
You're so right. It's these wonderful people who've been maybe on the East Coast in Brooklyn, or primarily, how many people from Hawaii go to college in Seattle?
Portland.
All right. Bend. San Diego is another big one. These are people who had it, they like it, and they expect it here.
They want it here. So now they're getting it in some ways. Does this
exactly
mean that we're going to see more breweries coming online? And what will be too much? What's the competition able to bear here?
That's what we're finding out. The audience only seems to be growing. And, you know, there's someone I want to introduce you to. He's someone who is here at the very, very beginning of the craft brew movement.
Does he have chocolate porter?
I'm sure he's made it. You know, Eddie May, let's make a request. He's Dave Campbell. People always talk about him. Brewmaster, partner in Aloha Beer Company there that's been on Queen about a year. He and his wife started the first homebrew store, supply store in Kaka'ako in 1994. He said he was brewing when he was a senior in high school. Okay, but then college, he was a history major, turned to brewmastering, and he came back here and started a supply store. He helped open Sam Choi's breweries. He helped open Honolulu Brewing on Cook there around the corner. A local spirit professional told me that the beer that Campbell and his brewer, Kyle Archer, make there at Aloha is absolutely world class.
Beer is always, beer's a beverage that was meant to be had close to the source. So back in the good old days, every little town would have a brewery that would supply, you know, as far as a horse could deliver beer. And then the next one over. So you have all these circles, you know. This horse is Powell. I'm stopping here. Next, you go take this one. Anytime you can get a beer close to the source is as it should be. And the whole craft beer scene is based on the roots of it is local production, local consumption. Manufacturing in Hawaii is nothing of what it used to be. So it's pretty cool. Like Kaka'ako is now, there's manufacturing in Kaka'ako again, you know.
Think about it. You know, that Red Fire Department museum that's there on Queen used to be a brewery. It was two different breweries went in and out of there. Now in that same section, what? We got four breweries happening.
And you don't need a horse.
Yeah, you don't need a horse. Yeah, you got to walk between these breweries. And talk about manufacturing, which is so cool for Hawaii. Waikiki Brewery that just opened up, they're going to be able to can in that location there on Queen Street. And they're working with a canning facility in Kapolei. Bethann,
which is to say this is really local, not something that has just the look of local or the local washing that we've seen.
So you recycle your beer can. It can be back in your hand again with a beer in it, I mean a local brew in it, in 2 months.
And a growler.
Growlers. I never even knew what that was, Bethann, until a couple of weeks ago.
You know now, and you're finding out a whole lot more, too.
I am. And those growlers, we'll have to explain that at a future date. But, you know, tonight a lot of people are going to be heading over to Waikiki Brew Company, and me, you might, too.
And you're going to give us lots more information about what's happening with breweries in Hawaii as we listen to your series. But nice to hear some of the other bits that won't be in some of those reports of yours.
We'll have to head over for some beer storming ourselves at some point, Bethann.
Well, let's see. A couple hours from now, that might be a good thing. Thanks, Noe. Noe Tanigawa is HPR's arts and culture reporter and now a beer connoisseur.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
There's always a wide variety of activities going on around the state, and we hear about them from Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, who joins us for a look at events going on in our community, might be a little under the radar. And one example, Derek, is a party in Papakolea.
That's right. The second annual Papakolea Pa'ina features music from Ke Aoho and Kuana Torres Kahele, who have both performed here in HPR's Atherton studio. Also, Natalie Aikamau and the Keawe Ohana, who are anti-Genoa's descendants. You can also enjoy Ono Hawaiian food, a keiki zone, cultural demonstrations and vendor booths. This is happening tomorrow at the Papakolea Community Park, located at 2150 Tantalus Drive from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. You can buy tickets at the link on our website.
Sounds like a perfect Saturday afternoon.
I know. Hawaiian music and food and all that.
What's not to like?
Right.
And there's a National Historic Site on Hawaii Island a lot of people might not know about.
Yes, the Pu'ukohola Heiau is holding a Hawaiian cultural festival at Pelikane Bay this weekend. And there will be arts and crafts workshops, demonstrations of things like ancient lei making, plus canoe rides and Hawaiian games. On Saturday, activities will be from 6 a.m. to 3 p.m., starting early. And on Sunday, it's from 9:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. This is at the Pu'ukohola Heiau on Hawaii Island.
That is an early start, 6 a.m., but, I know, Saturday you might as well get up early.
Sure, why not? I'm up anyway.
And, you know, the whole idea of making sandcastles has really been refined to a high art on Kauai.
That's right. And tomorrow you can win prizes making sandcastles. The free sandcastle art sculpture contest and festival is in Hanalei. You can build a sandcastle or make sand art. The contest is from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. tomorrow on the beach between Hanalei Pier and the pavilions. And this is for people of all ages, and they recommend you carpool.
Yeah, that's a great event. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more about them on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And on that note, we're going to say goodbye for this week, but we'll be back come Monday, and we'll look at new research on links between beehives and pesticides on Kauai.
And we'll expect an in-studio visit from Jerry Santos and Henry Capono.
Ooh, that's going to be good. Meanwhile, we'd like to hear from you, and if you can be in touch in many different ways, we'd be glad to see you on our talkback line. Listen to what you have to say. You can leave us your number, or your comments, rather, at 808-792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. On social media, you can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, go to The Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program, and Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkoek.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Join us on Monday when we pick up The Conversation. Have a great weekend.